That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR Show. This week, a dude from a band that has been cool for 30 fucking years. It's Neil Fallon. The band is Clutch. If you're listening to this episode on YouTube or Spotify or iHeartRadio, wherever the hell you're listening to this, it gets cut off about midway through. If you want to hear the whole episode, you go to gasdigital.com. Use the code SDR14. You're going to get a 14-day free trial. You could have heard this 5 days ago, commercial-free, at gasdigital.com. Watch the video in HD. Join the live chat when we stream live on Wednesdays and Saturdays. It's a fun place to be over at gasdigital.com. But really, all we care about is you getting the word out about the show. And this one is a doozy. It's the Clutch episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone walk the hole. It's weed, I beat. It's hookers and blow. It's art, you need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is The SDR Show, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me once again, feeling a little bit under the weather, but he's a goddamn trooper.
That's right.
James Madden.
I told you earlier, I feel like a Metallica song, baby. I feel like Creeping Death, but I'm going to get through it because I'm a professional.
You are a professional. By the way, so here's the story. This dude, this band, he's not going to know this because he doesn't listen to this fucking show, but normally I have like one page of notes when I research somebody. I had to condense it to two because there's just too much shit for this band. 30 years together, same fucking people from day one, pretty much. He's the lead singer. He's the rhythm guitarist. The band is Clutch. The dude is Neil Fallon. They have just announced their new World Samurai Tour for 2024. They're playing Aftershock. They're playing a bunch of other fucking festivals. 13 goddamn studio albums, a bunch of live albums. The most recent one was back in 22. That came out in 23 as an expanded called Sunrise on Slaughter Beach. It is Neil Fallon. Welcome to the show, dude.
Thank you for having me.
Let me say this first. Kudos on this.
Kudos.
No fucking social media. Fuck social media. I wish I could be that person. I use it solely because you have to when you're not at a certain level. But I also think it's funny because you have openly credited the internet for the resurgence of Clutch, yet you don't do social media.
Well, that's true. The band does.
I know the band does. Yeah, for sure.
Myself, I dabbled in it. You know, I was, you know, hammered over the head like a lot of people. Like, you're an artist. You need to connect with your fans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might have been fun for a little bit, but the novelty worn off. And I don't really think I was connecting with anything except the front of my phone.
Right.
I've become... You know, maybe I'm becoming like old man yells at clouds a little bit, but I'm kind of of the opinion that
welcome to the club.
Yeah. You know, the artist connects with their fans during the performance and everything after that is extemporaneous bullshit.
But here's a great story on that, by the way, because I don't think people often realize like the classic scenarios of bands, labels, fans, the way that works. I heard this story that you told where you never really sold well in Greece. But then one day someone says, you guys should fucking play Greece, and your label's against it, but you sell out because people were just sharing music. They didn't realize, before you could look up metrics and see if people are listening to things on streaming, they were just downloading me through Kazaa or LimeWire, who knows. But then you realize, oh shit, maybe we should just travel to places because that is the world we live in nowadays.
At that particular time, the internet was still a bit of a different territory, but Greece and a lot of other countries have a culture of, you know, bootlegging.
Right.
And it's, you can't really use album sales as a litmus test about how many people are going to come into a room to listen to you.
Right.
And the, you know, the agents were saying, well, look, you haven't sold any albums here. Why would you go? And, you know, worst case scenario, we play a room full of 50 people, but then we get to go to the Acropolis and eat awesome food and leave.
Right. Dope.
But it worked out well. It was a lot of people. And I think, you know, in the 90s and, well, decades and decades prior, A&R representatives were the gatekeepers of music. They would seek out talents and think who might make them a lot of money or who they believed in artistically or whatever. But now everybody can be their own A&R representative in a way.
Right. And you guys even, you took it a step further. You have your own label. We'll get into that as well. But first, we'll just go back to the beginning. You're born in an area called Fort Smith, I think, and then Washington State, then in Maryland, right?
Fort Smith, no. I was born in Portsmouth, Virginia. Maybe that's what it
Portsmouth,
is.
Sorry. Yeah, Portsmouth. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. And lived briefly out west, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, and then moved out here. Maybe 1981, 82. Mm-hmm. And here ever since, and met the guys in high school.
Right.
I've known John Paul since seventh grade.
But which is a hilarious story because, you know, you said this a few times, but it is a funny idea because sometimes you just realize, like we had, I go back to a 70s band, I think it was Foreigner maybe that we had on, where they were all neighbors and that's how they started their band, right? So you and John Paul, because your last name starts with F, his last name starts with G, you were just next to each other in the lockers and in the homeroom, and that's how that started. And 30 years later, you're still in a band together.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, kids, you know, that age will, you know, you have your different scenes and it hasn't changed. You got your jocks and your, you know, your academics, and then the ones that are neither of those things that just like music and writing Twisted Sister on their album, on their notebook cover, you know, and they find each other. And right. That's what we did. And Dan, our bass player, he lived down the block from me. And, you know, it's geographic, especially when you don't have a car, it's good to have a place that you can walk to or
right.
From a ride that doesn't sound like too much of a hassle.
And most of us at that age, you know, where I'm 54, I think you're a couple of years younger than me.
Yeah, 52.
Yeah. Your friends were proximity related for the most part, you know, that because there was no social media. There was no other way. It was people that lived near you or went to school with you. That was your friend base. And that was it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's like my wife and I have a son who's almost 14, and he's got friends in all these different schools, and it's all over the place. And I remember it's like a kid from another high school might as well have been a foreign exchange student.
Yeah, might as well. It is great. And forget about other countries or other states. Like, what the fuck? You know, just, it's wild. But so what I like is, you know, you openly talk about this. So your dad played piano, your mom played accordion, and your dad's record collection was like the first way you got into music. Like all of us, either an older brother or your parents is where you first absorb music. Although you said it's not like you were the Partridge Family. They weren't like virtuosos. It's just that was your initial exposure to music.
Yeah. It wasn't, you know, we were never forced to take music lessons or anything like that. Right. And I was very, you know, resistant to any of that anyway. But my dad's record collection was probably a lot like the graduating class of 1968, you know, it was the Beatles and, you know, then a lot of folk music and it's Bob Dylan. And I also inherited his 45 collection from when he was a teenager. So I listened to a lot of that, and that's the background. It's pretty, I think, typical.
What's cool is that you somebody asked you your favorite 80s albums, and one of them that you picked was Public Enemy Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And what's funny about that, it's a great record, but the line that made me laugh is that you went to high school and all these kids are wearing big clocks around their neck, and you're like, what the fuck is going on right now?
Yeah, that doesn't look very practical because they were like this big around.
Really funny. You didn't know who they were. You're like, what the fuck is happening?
No clue. Yeah.
I was a little young for that. So what, people like at high school were actually dressing like Flav?
Oh, yeah. They get the clock. I experienced that. I also remember watching people like in a circle, like dancing to that record. And it felt dangerous to me. I was like, what the fuck is happening right now? Crazy.
crazy how dangerous it is. I met Flav at a Super Bowl party like a month ago with a Viking hat on. And I go, not quite as dangerous as it was, but still cool that I'm eating them. But it was, it reminded me I've gotten old.
When we broadcasted the show live once from the cat house, not the cat house, the bunny ranch in the brothel in Vegas. And he was there, but he wouldn't come on the show unless we paid him. So we didn't do it. But by the way, a memory that you talked about that I'd like, because what a fucking cool thing to see is you saw Soundgarden opening for Voivod. Oh. That's just fucking unbelievable. And realizing at that point that this dude, Chris Cornell, was something special, right?
Yeah, I got to see them at the Bayou in 1989 in D.C. And you know, I loved Voivod. I loved Soundgarden. And this is, I think, right when Soundgarden was just beginning their skyrocket up. And I guess it was the Loud Love Tour or maybe even prior to that.
Wow.
And Ultra Mega?
Maybe. It was like fall of 1989. And I just remember they opened for Voivod and then the place cleared out. And I stuck around for Voivod. I felt terrible for him. But what Chris Cornell was just from another planet vocally. Right. And that was cool to see. And that was one of those moments where I saw a band. I was like, this band's going to be huge.
That's cool.
You could kind of taste it in the air.
And also, by the way, James always makes fun of me for this, but kind of easy on the eyes as well. He was a good-looking dude, and he stayed good-looking until the end. He was always a cool-looking dude. Good-looking motherfucker. Kid. And then also you saw Bad Brains at some famous, I forget where this is, the 930 Club's like a legendary spot, right?
D.C.
Yeah, that's there's a current location, there's the prior location, and 930 Club was the hostess, you know, legends of punk rock, not only in D.C., but East Coast or everywhere. I mean, West Coast, Europe. And I, you know, kind of missed the golden age of, you know, D.C. hardcore and punk. I was a bit young for that. But I did get a chance to see some bands, and that was one of them. And they set the bar kind of so high right out of the
best
gate that I haven't seen anything since.
Right.
Because I was the perfect age for it.
Yeah.
I was, you know, maybe 16 or 17 and hungry for it all. And, you know, could handle that kind of situation physically. And, you know, that made a big first impression.
That's so cool.
I remember that show, you know, more vividly than whatever YouTube video I saw last night.
Of course. I mean, just like you're going to remember the first time you fall in love better than the 50th time, you know, it is what it is. And by the way, James always, I wouldn't say you make fun of me. You give me accolade for doing crazy research, but let's see if I'm right with this.
You're very good, my friend. You are the new Ed Bradley.
The first album he ever bought himself, he got through a Columbia record deal, and it was Blondie's Auto American. Am I right on that?
It was my parents. Yes. Well, to answer your question, yes.
Good job and a good record, sir.
It is a good record. I think I was more intrigued by Debbie Harry.
Yeah.
I mean, who wasn't?
And, you know, I was still, God, I was probably 9-10 years old, but they signed up for that Columbia clearinghouse where it's like you get 28 tracks for a penny, but then you're contractually obligated to buy one every month for the next 4 years. So they
the next four decades, I'm still paying it off.
Was a fun scam, by the way. It was a great scam that doesn't exist anymore. It was like one of the first scams. So it's pretty cool.
That's how I got my first record. I guess I didn't really pay for it from my own money in retrospect, but I remember buying ZZ Top's Eliminator at Kent Mill Records. You know, that was and Van Halen 84. Some of the first ones I remember vividly buying.
Excellent records.
So you guys are all in the same area. You and your drummer are alphabetically conjoined at that point.
Yeah.
So at what point do we decide, hey, guys, maybe we should try and do a band? Because I thought, am I right that you weren't originally the singer and then became the singer?
That's correct. Well, we had different iterations of this band. I mean, half the fun was just coming up with a new name.
Right.
And a new direction, you know, because after 2 months, you decided you wanted to change directions, even though you hadn't written a damn song. we were high school bands of different, you know, stripes. And then we graduated, and John Paul, Tim, and Dan started another band called Glut Trip. They had a singer, Roger, and he couldn't do a show or two, and they asked me to fill in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been filling in ever since.
And also, you guys were just fans of monosyllabic names. You were fans of Prong, and that's where Clutch came from, right? Prong, by the way, one of my favorites. He's been on the show years ago, but
Tommy Victor's one of our heroes before we met him, and since we've gotten to know him, yeah, still is. They were, I think, criminally overlooked band.
By the way, I can vividly remember, you're talking about vivid memories, the first time I heard Snap Your Finger, Snap Your Neck, I was like, what the fuck am I listening to right now? I was so like, what is going on?
And we went to go see Prong play at this club in Baltimore. God, it must have been like 1992, all four of us. And Tommy Victor got up on, and Baltimore didn't have a football team at the time. And Tommy was upset with the low turnout. And he said something to the effect of, what the fuck's wrong with your city? You don't deserve a football team anyway. Fuck you. And then
balls
went on to do the rest of the set. And we kind of ate it up. We loved the abuse.
That's fucking great. And also, am I right that your first big tour was opening for Limp Bizkit with Seven Dust?
No, our first big tour was opening for Biohazard in Europe.
Oh, okay. But you did do that tour. You did open for Limp Bizkit with Seven Dust at some point, right?
That is correct. We had done some tours prior to that, like okay. Sepultura we did Marilyn Manson. I don't know if that was before. I think that was Marilyn Manson was before that. I can't keep it straight, but yeah, we did that Limp Bizkit tour.
Just because I see a lot of similarities. I've been friends with the Seven Dust guys for years, and there's a lot of similarities in your bands. The same lineups, Road Dogs, great live performances, consistently great records. Do you get that a lot? Do people kind of lump you guys together?
I think we're similar in that, you know, well, we kind of started at the same time
and
managed to kind of, you know, hammer out a niche for ourselves with a fan base that are really dedicated to the fan, to the band and the music, despite not really having a whole lot of radio love over the years. And that's what happens when you tour like Road Dogs. You build a house, you know, with a solid foundation as opposed to the next big thing. And usually the next big thing is forgotten the next summer.
Yeah, much, much quicker. All right, before we go any further, these guys have been a part of this show for 4 years and going strong. And if you are a fan of Kratom, there is nowhere else to go but YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. You know that we've been fans of these guys for years. Shannon loves the Trainwreck one. There's a lot of custom strains, custom blends, all available there at YoKratom.com. And you get it in that cool $60 kilo format, and you know that it's going to ship fast, and you know it's going to be fresh, and you know it's going to be high-quality Kratom. No longer are you wondering how long that Kratom's been sitting on that gas station shelf. So go to YoKratom.com and stock up now. YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. Let's get back into it. Let me ask you, because, you know, you guys now, as I said, I think it's 13 records, getting better with age, in my opinion. Like, it's also funny, like, the one that everyone knows, Electric Worry, is like your sixth record. It's not like it was the hit from the first record. You know, it's pretty wild that it was midway through your career, technically, you know, the sixth record before that song that most people know came out. Do you remember the moment, because of how you just put it, never had huge hits, we're building a fan base, where you realize, okay, we're going to be in this, we have to look at this like a business. We're not punks anymore. We're getting older, and start looking at it more like this is a job now. I mean, we still love it. We're having fun, but we need to start looking at this as an entity as opposed to just four high school schmucks having fun.
Yeah, I do. And
that's a big moment, I would imagine. You know, that's like a big, that's a real moment.
Yeah, you gotta have the kind of the dark night of the soul, or like maybe just a serious moment of reflection. Because sure, when you're 20 years old, 21 years old, and you're touring in a van, it's great fun. It's the great adventure. And then all of a sudden you start thinking, okay, well, now I'm pushing 30 and I have a wife, and maybe there's a kid coming around the corner, yeah, and I don't want to live in a truck stop. And I was for many years of the mind that this was something I was going to do before I did the thing I hated. Cause you know, my dad, you know, I love my dad, but he's one of those guys that's sort of the school of, well, if you're not miserable, you're not working hard enough.
That's funny.
That kind of ilk. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, man, I need to find something that makes me miserable. This is not work. But then it was right around the late 90s after Pierrock Fury. I was like, man, I don't know if I can do this. And then we had got dropped by a third label, which was okay. It was fine. It mm-hmm. was not, that wasn't the reason. It was just like, okay, we're going to have to get back in the van without tour support. We're almost 30 years old. Do we want to do this? And I think everyone was like, screw it. We went all in and kind of started again. And then we wrote Blast Tyrant and was sort of, that was a second wind for this band
mm-hmm.
that we've kind of been, you know, feeling that ever since in a lot of ways. And it made a big difference, you know, starting our own record label, but we could talk about that later. Like you said, if you like.
Yeah. Well, let me, since you brought up Blast Tyrant, I have fucking two pages of notes here on you, but the song Electric Worry, it's very interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize, I think the right word is it's an interpolation or it's a pseudo cover, but it's two old school blues songs kind of melded together and your spin on it. It's like a hybrid of all three. Is it a song that you have to pay rights to someone else or is it an entity upon itself? Because it is, if you listen to that Muddy Water song and you listen to that Fred McDowell song, there's elements of both there, but then there's also your parts of it too.
Yeah. Well, the short answer is, yeah, we don't own the writing of that outright. And mm-hmm. we probably could have in hindsight, because one, those lyrics are in like 50 different blues songs.
A lot of blues songs.
I've heard that lick in a lot of blues songs, but I was introduced to that with Mississippi Fred McDowell. And I honestly kind of felt ethically compelled to say, you know what, this is me just kind of jacking this. I'm not gonna say I pulled this out of the sky. And I had this image that maybe Fred McDowell's, great grandchild might get some, you know, a couple $100 every year or so. That's not the case. It's owned by a publishing company.
Of course.
I think Chris Christopherson actually owns the publishing.
Oh, wow.
So we're paying Chris a little bit here and there.
Wouldn't it be ironic if Jimmy Page and Robert Plant owned all the blues publishers? That'd just be spectacular. Yeah. Who's getting that money? Fred McDowell's great grandkid? Fucking Jimmy Page and his 18-year-old wife.
It makes me think of that great fucking movie, Searching for Sugar Man, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but.
Because that's about Sixto Rodriguez, right?
Yeah, and it's about the guy, it starts out with the guy tracking down who's getting the money for the record sales. It's a fascinating, I got to see him live once too, which is cool.
I haven't seen the movie. I love his music. I once was behind him in a line at catering at a festival, and he had his gig bag, you know, strapped to his back as he's piling potatoes on his plate, and he, like, just on the back of his gig bag in Sharpie, it just said Sixto, and I was like, wow, you're like 70 years old and you're just walking around with your gig bag like it's high school with your name on it. And it's kind of inspiring, you know.
That's
just
cool.
Like, this guy's not quitting. He's
just keep working
right to the end.
But pretty just dope. To put a button on Electric Worry, it's also funny that you were the one that thought it didn't belong on the record. And that ended up being the song that everyone knows you for the most part.
Isn't that that's a pretty common thing. You hear that from a lot of bands. I mean, I was like, man, this is really different. I don't know if it fits on the record. And a lot of times you can grow so close to something, you're the last person to make the correct judgment call.
Yeah.
Typically.
I mean, you also hear, like, you know, fucking Black Sabbath wrote Paranoid because they needed to fill 2.5 minutes, you know, so they just jotted it down in 20 seconds and that was the song. Crazy. Now, speaking of that, it's just, I find fascinating. I don't know, and James, you might know better than I on this, but you guys, like, democratically put your playlist together where each night one of you makes a list and that's the set list for the night for the most part, I think, which means that you all have to know I don't know how many songs it is. 150 songs, I'm guessing. I don't know that you have to be ready to play because you never know what the next dude's going to put in the set list that night. Is that fair?
Usually by the end of a tour, there's about 60 to 70 songs we can choose from on any given night. If there's a song that somebody gets a bee in their bonnet that they want to play, we'll say, hey, I'm thinking about playing this song, you know, in a couple days. So it gives the opportunity to like get up to speed. It makes it more interesting for us, especially if you're going to do it day in, day out. I can't imagine being in a band doing the same set list every night.
That's most of them, right? I mean, that is most of them.
Well, I understand like big, huge acts that are kind of where they're subordinated by the production. We're like, okay, you have to do the same set list because the pyro is going to go off
right
now.
Right.
But if you're not beholden to that, man, I think it's more exciting. And I think the fans could pick up on it.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing thing for the fans because they never know what, if anything, also makes them want to learn the whole catalog more than just the hits because you never know what you're going to see.
Especially when we're on the East Coast and the cities are of the United States, they're closer together, or even the UK, we'll get people coming to sequential shows knowing that the sets will be different.
Right.
And that's cool, man. It's very gratifying to see people have that appetite for it.
The one thing I was going to bring up with the interpolation thing, the song Immortal that you guys wrote with Leslie West, you found out years later that that riff was actually, he lifted himself. Right? It's in an old Mountain song.
It isn't an old Mountain song that we didn't know until later.
Right. You didn't know, but is it he brought it to the table too, though, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah. You want to hear a funny anecdote that I've never shared publicly about that song?
Sure.
Okay, so he's replaying the riff, and he's got these lyrics. And he's calling the song Fuzzy Peach. And the lyrics are something about... I love to eat her peach in the morning. I love to eat her peach in the night. And every morning, there's peach fuzz in my sheets. And it was like, wow, man. I mean, Leslie, well, okay. It's not really clutch, you know, material, but let's see what I can do. And I remember writing the lyrics out for Immortal, which have clearly nothing to do with that. He was sitting in the studio reading these lyrics, and he's got his glasses on and a cigar, and he's going, who's the man who stole fire for the people? Who causes tremblings in the bones of evil? I am immortal? And he looks at me, he goes, Neil, what about that theme we discussed? I said, Leslie, what theme are you talking about? He says, Neil, you know, eating pussy.
And he's what, in his 50s?
At the time, no, he's probably in his 70s.
He's probably older than that.
Yeah.
For some reason, YouTube every day suggests a video I've seen already 1,000 times of Mountain on some TV show doing Mississippi Queen. He's missing a tooth. And every time they suggest it, I watch it. It is the greatest thing ever. And when he smiles, you're repulsed and happy at the same time.
I used a nightclub promoter.
Said that it was his favorite. Jimmy said Leslie was his favorite electric guitar player.
Dude, everyone should, when they're done listening to this wonderful podcast, go watch that fucking video. It changes your life. They jam like no one's business. It's insane.
I was a rock club promoter in New York, and I did a show with Leslie West. We booked him, and he performed live.
Beast.
Probably in 1991 or 92, somewhere around there. Pretty wild.
Eating pussy. His old
eating pussy. You should, by the way, you should put out his version. You're always putting out like, you know, reissues with the PA tapes and remixes. You should put out his version. That'd be fucking hilarious.
Yeah. Oh boy. That would
put out one single. Eating pussy. Leslie West with Clutch. Come on.
Leslie West wants us all to eat pussy.
That's take a chance, baby. It's the 21st century. You don't get off the island bunting. Come on.
One of the cool Easter eggs, because people always ask you guys, because it's an interesting dichotomy, good word, everybody, that it's really well-constructed music with light, a little bit of levity in the lyrics. And so it's like almost like a thinking man's rock band. It's kind of interesting. And I've heard of several people ask you about, like, are there Easter eggs in the artwork? Are there Easter eggs in lyrics? And one thing I think is fascinating is Jay Robbins, who I think worked with you on several albums, if not all the albums, has put a triangle hit in every single song he's worked on somewhere.
Well, not every, that's correct, almost. He's put it on an album.
Every album, sorry, every album like he's worked on.
One triangle hit that's really, he claims it's audible in the mix, but the fact of the matter is everyone in my band, including myself, our high-end hearing is so shot.
Well, we're all old. Sir.
Yeah, we're never going to hear it, but it's there. So if someone wants to take the time and go through Robot Hive Exodus and listen very closely for one triangle hit, be my guest. And
I'm surprised, knowing your fan base, that that hasn't happened yet. Like, the Triangle Guide to Clutch is not like some sort of website. I'm surprised it's not.
Yeah, he does it. He does it on every album he records, not just us. And he does it secretly at night when the band isn't at the studio, so no one knows except him.
That's pretty cool. And also, you guys became synonymous with a shit ton of video games. Like, I think over like maybe a dozen video games. Who was behind that? Like, who started working you guys into I think Far Cry 5 and Rock Band and Hitman and Tony Hawk. Like, who's the one that made that happen?
Don't forget Farming Simulator 4.
Oh, how could I? I'm sorry.
I mean, that's the classic.
Our publicist will do that, and sometimes it comes directly from the video game creators.
Mm-hmm.
One other anecdote about video games and us, we started getting hate mail from the Hitman 2 community because it wouldn't get played on, I think, Steam. And there was some rumor that it was us who weren't allowing Furok Fury to be used on Steam. And it was in the original release.
Uh-huh.
But what it was is that Sony owned the publishing for that song. And I guess Steam was in a competitor's umbrella company. And it was some corporate nonsense we had no idea about. But the level of ferocity from the Hitman 2 community was unbelievable. It was...
And you know they can shoot guns, so it makes it even scarier.
Oh, yeah, so accurate and fast.
All right, thanks for listening to about 50% of the Neil Fallon episode of Clutch. Right now, if you go to gasdigital.com, use the code SDR14, you're going to get a 14-day free trial. Listen to the rest, download other episodes, and fucking cancel. I don't care. Just check out gasdigital.com.